the author of the Divergent series, Chicagoan Veronica Robb, Juan Fun Chef Austin Baker, and live music in Studio 435 from the Purcells. And now here's your host, a man who thought the Women's March was Sunday, Justin Kaufman.
I went down there with my sign. I was like, where is that? Where is it on Columbus? Maybe I'm on Jackson. Should I go to Wabash? Anybody? So I just showed my solidarity by taking my sign to the only open Dunkin' Donuts downtown. And this is how you do it. Sometimes that's how democracy. What democracy looks like. How y'all doing? It's Justin Kaufman here with you till 11 o'clock here on WGN Radio. It's the download. We got a lot to do tonight. I'm so excited. Veronica Roth will be my guest at the big table tonight, the author of the Divergent series. One of the, I would say arguably one of the, if not one, I would say the number one young adult author working today. And she lives right here in Chicago. We're going to talk to her. She's got a brand new book, Carve the Mark. We're going to talk with her about her career, about the characters, about the new story. Lots to talk to Veronica Roth about. She'll be my guest up coming up at 8 o'clock. At 7:30, though, it's an episode of Touche. Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling together to give us a debrief to argue about Trump Day 1. A lot of stuff went down today, including the sort of nixing of the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement. Also, a hiring freeze for federal workers. So a lot to talk about today on day one, officially day one of the Trump administration. Also coming up tonight, Austin Baker will be here. He is the man behind the new One Fun and Two Fun Chinese restaurants in the West Loop, Sichuan in Chicago. Also talk about Chinese New Year's. That's coming up on Saturday. And the Purcells are live in Studio 435, some indie rock for us tonight. So we got a great show lined up for you tonight. So we're going to get to it. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, it's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you to 11. We've got a great show lined up, so let's get to it. Start with the carryout. This, of course, our nightly segment where I read the news so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Well, it's the formal day one for President Trump. The weekend wasn't supposed to count. It did. So what do we know? Well, Mr. Trump signed an executive order to kill the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement, which really wasn't a thing because, well, it never went to Congress. Then he froze hiring of all federal workers. Why? Well, Sean Spicer explained, when he wasn't yelling at the press, that this was a way to respect the American taxpayer and to root out corruption and special interests. So the idea is that federal workers are scamming the American public? Is that a thing? Really? Still? Talk about a boogeyman. A union rep said that the current federal workforce is 10% lower than it was in 1967. Also, critics say that the backlog of federal government work is so large that we will end up spending more money on contractors coming in to do the work. So get rid of salaried positions with all that healthcare nonsense and replace it with contractors. All right, well, that kind of seems like where we're at right now. Is the point to make America great again, or is it to make America pay less for labor again? Oh, yeah, I guess that last one's too long for a hat. Is it me, or does bringing American jobs back mean lowering taxes for American corporations? That seems like what this is all about. And if you're doing that, that means revenue that the government usually uses to pay for itself isn't available. So instead of finding new revenues or having business pay fair share, Trump is just going to lower expenses. At the expense of who? Remember, most of the jobs lost in modern times weren't because companies left America. It's because companies automated their workforce. So can we just all agree that we should just put a tax on robots?
No, please don't. What? No, I can't afford taxes plus my Cavarici jeans.
They never said that they had good fashion, right? The Trump administration is questioning the attendance numbers at the inauguration. Nope. Pass. No. We're not doing it. Wait, so Americans don't care about tax returns, but they do care about crowd size. You know what I say to that? Something's burning. It's my new catchphrase. Smell that? Something's burning. No, got to work on it. I'll work on it. Now it's time for the Download's Public Shaming Report. An SNL writer, a woman on a plane, and a board member at a local school. Guess what? You've been shamed. We've spoken and we want justice for the dumb stuff that you said on social media. Wait, what are we talking about here? The president of the United States tweets incendiary material every other hour. Either we're okay with un-PC or we're not. The middle, it's a bit cray-cray, right? Something's burning. No, darn it. It might stick. Just keep doing it, right? An environmental activist from Rhode Island was walking barefoot across the country to raise awareness for climate change, but that track ended when he was struck and killed by a vehicle. It's terrible. What was the vehicle? Please tell me it was a Prius. Please tell me it was a Prius. Ah, an SUV. Darn it. Missed the irony. In weather, well, it's going to get a bit colder. Still, 40s in late January? I'm about to take the tarp off my outdoor jacuzzi. No, I'm not. It's broken. Is there anyone that actually has an outdoor jacuzzi that works? It's just not possible. After the first week, it works. After that, forget it. In sports, man, I wish I could watch the replay of that corner blitz clocking Aaron Rodgers on a loop for the rest of my life. The Falcons dismembered the pack to head to the Super Bowl. The Falcons are going to the Super Bowl. The Falcons. All right. They're going to take on the New England Patriots, who walloped the Steelers, much like they did in the first week of the season. Say what you will, but yesterday was pretty terrible football. Two blowouts in championship games. What happened to parity? Watching those games, I'm not sure how you stop the Patriots. Maybe, I don't know, suspend them for something fake? You do that. Bears connections in this year's Super Bowl. You're not going to like this, but linebacker and former Bears number one Shea McClellan's making plays. And the black unicorn, Martellus Bennett, starting at tight end. The Bears got news that guard Josh Sitton is now in the Pro Bowl because a Packer got hurt yesterday. Actually, it was the guy who was crying on the sideline. Gosh, man. To get carted off in the second half of a blowout. One moment, you're thinking about where you're going to go for your offseason. Maybe I'll go fishing off Florida. Next thing you know, you're doing jumping jacks in a rehab pool in Oshkosh. Oh, that's terrible. ESPN now has the Bears picking Alabama defensive end Jonathan Allen, their mock draft with a third pick. CBS Sports has coach John Fox at number four on the coaches on the hot seat ranking, which I did not know was a thing. There you go. In college basketball news, the Northwestern Wildcats did something they haven't done in a gazillion years, and that's beat Ohio State in Columbus. They're the third. They're third now in the Big Ten, and they're 16-4. This is huge. Big games do await the Wildcats, including games with Indiana and Wisconsin. But hey, this is looking like the year. Don't want to jinx it. Can you jinx things in college basketball? I'm not even sure how that works. And finally, the new Star Wars movie has a name. It's going to be called Star Wars: The Last Jedi. The earlier working title was Star Wars. We're going to make $1 trillion. I guess that didn't roll off the tongue. Wasn't good for the poster. Well, that's the carryout for January 23rd, 2017. Hey, our menu now has a nutritional guide. It's alternative facts, though, so everything has zero calories. It's fat-free. All right, coming up, it's time for Touche, Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy. Get their gloves on and get ready to spar over the beginning of the Trump administration. A lot of activity today. So I'm sure we'll get a lot of arguing. Dave and Chris coming up after the news. Stay with us. It's a download on 720 WGN. Rob Martyr, how are you, my man?
You know, I'm good and bad, Justin. I'm good and bad.
Here we go.
I'm upset that the Steelers didn't have at least a better showing against the Patriots.
I wasn't
sure if they were going to win, but Le'Veon Bell goes down. I mean, D'Angelo Williams filled in well enough, but it just, you know, that was kind of a bit of a...
I don't want to get too inside football,
yeah,
but I don't understand why the Steelers defense plays a zone against Tom Brady and those receivers, and that's
right.
What they do.
Yeah.
They find a little spot in the zone. That's why they're so short. You know, they just need to...
Hey, but on the flip
like
side...
mice.
You know, on
they
the flip side... I know. On the flip side, though, I still stand to win $60 up here in the newsroom because I still have the Falcons in the pool.
All right,
so,
there you go. I don't have a lot of faith, but I would like to see the Falcons win, you know?
You and me both.
Yeah, right.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche! This may be the most important touche since the last touche.
It's really a fun touche.
It's just unreal.
So fun,
Justin,
man.
I'm not sure where they're going with this.
David's grousing, and I'm smiling.
I feel like every single day there's nothing off limits. Saturdays, Sundays, we saw this was a tremendous start to the Trump administration from the inauguration.
It's like 7 days a week almost, as if that's a job.
Dave, talk about the inauguration. What were your thoughts on the speech and the pageantry and everything that
came out? As one who predicted Hillary to win.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying that.
As one who predicted the candidate who forgot to campaign in Wisconsin to win, what are your insights about the event on Friday?
I very much appreciate your warmth and your sympathy, Chris. As one who predicted that Donald Trump would win 40 states.
Hey, I came a lot closer.
Yeah. So in any event, look, I think that Trump's speech, his inaugural address, I couldn't help but focus on the fact that he used Lincoln's Bible to swear himself in, or to be sworn in. And
this is not Napoleon on December 2nd, 1802.
Lincoln, with malice towards none and charity for all. And instead we got that unbelievable charity for none and malice for all. It was just an unbelievable, just another campaign speech. Everybody's been waiting for Donald Trump to grow into the presidency. I remember back last year when he said, you just wait. I could be presidential. If I'm presidential, nobody's going to pay any attention to me.
Presidential you've ever seen.
Exactly. Dude, you're president.
Everybody says I'm great at being president.
You're president. You got to stop being a petty little teeny tiny man.
He did it
again today, but we'll get to that.
Yeah, Chris. So a lot of the backlash was about.
Hold on. The news right now is that Pompeo got himself.
He's in.
Yeah. He got himself confirmed. What was that, Chris?
He got himself confirmed over at the United States
so
Senate.
But stay on
and
the inauguration.
And Tillerson's going to go.
We'll go in order.
The inauguration was great. It was a vast success. Thank you.
Media backlash. Let's go
media
there.
Backlash. The media, it's not media. I want to say, you're dealing with a multi-headed monster called the establishment. The media is just one, probably the most visible, prominent. I mean, Meryl Streep is one of the multi-heads. But you know what I'm saying? That Judd Ashley or Ashley Judd or whatever.
Apatow.
And this is where you start to sound crazy.
You got the celebrities, you got the media, right. You got the academy, you got all the think tanks, you got the office holders, and you got the custodians of right opinion, and they all say the status quo is fine, and people like Trump are idiotic, and the voters have said we don't care about the status quo, we want change, and Trump is our guy. So rough around the edges, you bet. No problem.
So I think that when Sean Spicer gets fired next week, Chris should take his place because he's just as good as obfuscating. Because the answer to your question about the inaugural and how was it? It was great. Move on. Nothing
Look,
to see here.
I believe I posted
it
my
was
view
the
on
most
that.
Poorly attended inaugural in recent memory. There were more than 2.5 times the number of people who marched the day after than marched the day of. And Donald Trump, who is the president, by the way, is such a petty little vindictive man. Right. He sent Sean Spicer out to lie to national television in what Kellyanne Conway called alternative facts. By the way, alternative facts, hashtag, we're going to ring that around your neck for the next 4 years.
We're not coming here to read the
That's
paper.
The leading from behind.
David, you don't have to
of 2017.
Thank you. Okay, we don't have to read the paper from this morning. I think that the speech was actually brilliant, and I think that the speech is going to stand the test of time. And I believe, actually, if you want to find a pretty good exegesis of the speech, go to the...
Exegesis, word of the day.
Go to the Saturday morning New York Times. They did a terrific job. I credit the Times. I actually thought there were 3 or 4 really good news articles in the Times on Saturday morning describing what was going on. And I have spent as much time on Twitter or some Facebook with David praising the folks who demonstrated and protested on Saturday. Long may they reign, and God bless them for it. And I hear the distinction between the anarchists who are lighting the cars on fire and the anti-Trump people or the pro-women people or whoever.
Well, that was Friday.
That was Friday, and all this stuff. But, I think, and David says it's the least attended, maybe, maybe not. But the fact is, it was the most watched because when you add up the TV and the online and YouTube and everything else. Yeah. The other thing I do want to say, I thought Spicer did extremely well today. I think it was a lousy day Saturday. I declared that on WGN television this morning to be a mulligan. you know, that's when you take your first shot on the golf course and you shank it and then you get to do it over. I think that was a mulligan. Who cares? None of this is important. What's important to regular people and how the economy's been strangled, and now they've got a guy in there who's meeting today with the trade unions. Did you see sheet metal, carpenters, plumbers, joiners, glazers, all the trades were in the White House today.
I want to talk about
specific
this.
Ideas about how to improve the economy. And also, who else were there? The corporate chieftains. So that's the kind of guy Trump is, because he builds 90-story buildings
but
with
Chris,
the trades.
Wouldn't you, I mean, and you'd be the first to say this because we've talked about this on Touche. I mean, it is, you could say it's all the press and you could say it's all the left that want to talk about the inauguration results, but it was Donald Trump himself and Sean Spicer who brought this to the forefront.
How many times have I said three big problems with Trump? One is conflicts of interest.
Right.
One is impulse control. And I would say the third is details or facts. And David wants to make something out of alternative. You know what? If there are 10 facts about a given situation and the media is going to talk about four and Spicer's going to go out there and talk about four other facts out of the list of 10, those are alternative facts. I got news for David.
Oh, good grief. That is some serious spinning, my friend.
No, it's not.
Those are
it's
alternative
absolutely
facts.
Absolutely true.
No, they're not alternative facts. He was telling falsehoods on Saturday.
That's not true.
Kellyanne Conway was telling falsehoods
can
on
I,
Sunday.
Can I say
and
that?
The fact that he went to the CIA, I mean, and this is what
this
Leon
is a
Panetta.
This story that got totally
This is what
obscure.
Leon Panetta said. This is what the former head of the CIA said. This is what a whole bunch of career officers, retired career officers have said. They were stunned that Trump goes to the CIA, by the way, apparently with an entourage of 40 people, according to CBS News, of his own people. You know, those are the people in the front row who are the
no,
clapping
they were
and cheering.
Not one of the people. You see, this is the David is so bereft of policy success from 8 years of Obama. He's got to come up with the false
76
facts.
Months of continuous job growth. Ooh, boop. I lost one there. Yeah.
He has to come up with the false facts of the media, the mainstream media narrative. And the fact
deficit
is,
cut into a quarter. Go ahead. Keep going.
And the fact is that
you want to challenge me on facts of success? I can go there. Sorry, the fact. The alternative facts. Sorry. Give me your alternative facts. My alternative fact is I climbed Everest on Sunday. What's your alternative fact?
That's not an alternative fact because it's untrue, David.
All right, here's what we're going to do. We'll take a break. I want to come back. There's two big things. Today, like you said, we talked about the executive order of scrapping the TPP.
Scrap it, baby.
Trans-TTP.
We're out.
And also, I want to talk about the Women's March on Saturday because that sent a message to the Trump administration about a lot of social issues that are concerned to many people in this country. We'll see if that was effective in getting his attention and possibly steering him towards different issues in the future. Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling, my guest tonight, Touche, stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
Well, that's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche. You go
right. Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling, it's Touche here Monday nights on The Download. We're talking national politics, lots to get through. We'll go quickly because it's been talked about a lot. The Women's March on Saturday brought out hundreds of thousands of people in cities across America, including here in Chicago. What does it mean? What is the message that's being sent to the Trump administration that so many people, I mean, came out in force all across America to protest?
First, I think we I don't want to glance over this.
He said we're going fast.
Yeah, we're not. There were 4+ million people that protested around the country yesterday, plus at least another million around the world.
Largest in
I
U.S.
mean,
history?
This was the largest in U.S. history. It was a mammoth demonstration. It's more than 1% of the population came out on one day to tell our new president, don't screw with us.
I thought they were telling Hillary, we forgot to vote for you.
They did vote for Hillary.
Yeah, most of them did, I'm sure.
If those people
I'm sure
had
there
voted
was,
for Hillary...
Yes, I'm sure there were some people there who voted for Jill Stein.
I think it's probably more people who sat in their house and didn't come downtown and think that didn't vote for...
No, I got to tell you, it was amazing. I mean, look, unfortunately, we had to... I had family obligations on Saturday morning. I couldn't protest. I felt badly, and my wife felt even worse because she really wanted to be there. But it was just an amazing gathering. I saw so many pictures from all around the country. And what they are saying, and look, what they're saying is, don't screw with us. The second thing they're saying is... we are going to be here and we are going to try to hold you accountable. And I say try. President, the president in his cabinet did something astonishing. There are fewer women and minorities here than in almost 50 years. There's two women, one African-American, not a single Latino in the entire. And so the angry white man won. There are none. None of those darn minorities and women in the cabinet.
Let me ask you this.
That was a Republicans, tour of Dave Lundy's inner intellect.
Does President Trump and the Republican Party, when they see this kind of mass protest, do they say, you know what, let's focus on the economy. Let's not focus on reproductive rights. Let's not focus on repealing Roe v. Wade. Let's focus on doing things that
too late.
They
did the gag rule today.
Hold on.
They do that all the time, though.
One of the first things they did was reinstate the Mexico City policy. They're vitally concerned with reproductive issues and the defense of the unborn. And you heard that absolutely front and center today at the briefing. And I think that the kind of diversity that David is saying he cares about was certainly shown to be absent from the protests when they found out that one of the groups that had signed up to participate as women who are concerned about Trump, they were invited to leave because their group happens to believe in pro-life stuff. So there isn't any intellectual diversity on that side. And
nonsense.
That's exactly why the protest, long may it wave, God bless every one of them. I know a lot of folks, my alumni page at my college, I can't believe how many of my fellow graduates of my year were actually out in force in Washington, blah, blah. Great stuff. Great stuff. It's what makes America so terrific. And it will have, I think, you know, I think it adds texture to the weekend. It's a counterpoint to the inauguration.
I think that you will see a political movement that comes out of that march. It was too big for it to just be for everyone to go back business as usual. All right, so let's talk more about what happened today.
Today.
The Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement is no longer, even though I don't think it ever was a thing because it didn't get through Congress. But
because Obama announced it without the requisite
support. The
there you
the
go
votes.
Again,
so here we
Chris.
Go. Oh, so here's a question.
That's exactly right. He announced it without the votes, and he never,
so it never
fashioned
was a thing.
It. So he made this. A part of his pivot to Asia was we're going to have a new regime of trade comity, and we're going to have a trade relationship with Asia that's going to make everybody prosperous.
Right.
And he couldn't deliver. I mean, the fact is, this was a dead letter.
Who was stopping the agreement from going forward? I'm just trying to remember that.
The point
who's in control of the Senate that wouldn't allow the agreement to go forward, Chris?
If you're going to have trade.
You can't blame a guy for not getting an agreement through when you're the one stopping the agreement getting through.
If he is going to go out and say, he goes international and says, I'm getting you an agreement. And he hasn't lined up the votes back home. He's the one who looks a
fool. Once upon a time,
not
Republicans
the guys who were
forget
opposed.
About
Republicans
Obama.
Were
forget
institutionalists.
Obama.
Not
on,
anymore.
Let's talk Trump. What does he do now?
Trump
because what
is,
I've seen is
Trump
that the
believes
Chinese,
in bilateral trade agreements, not multilateral.
Okay.
Okay. And so his beef with the multilateral agreements is it gives every element in the multilateral group, whether it's
equal
Asian
footing, right?
Or equal footing. And then
we shouldn't have equal footing with some
of
these
countries. And then it becomes a race to the bottom because the weakness of the weakest economy in that particular group ends up dictating the trade policy of that treaty. Mm-hmm. So his thing is, look, we're big. We're a big market. We're the greatest market on earth. And
so we're going one-to-one with these
people
guys.
Want access to our market, then we'll do one-on-one. And Theresa May is coming on Friday. And
do you run the risk of giving more power to a China who comes in and replaces America in this concept of a global economy?
Yes. It's not even a close call. This is
China is rejoicing
I don't agree with the left of my party that said trade agreements are bad. Trade agreements historically for the United States have generally been very good. They are confusing trade agreements with globalization. Globalization is here to stay. We have international flights. We have international ships. Goods and services are traveling around the world. You can't stop the wave of progress. But I just want to make one point about what Chris just said about it being a race to the bottom when you have multilateral agreements. A race to the bottom is exactly what the Trump people are trying to do with the replacement for Obamacare by allowing you to have insurance sold across 50 state lines. This is exactly the argument Democrats have been making.
I'm going to have to go to Northwestern for the whipsaw on my neck.
No, this is the exact argument Democrats have been making, which is that if you allow Alabama to set the insurance policy, you're going to have the worst insurance possible.
Okay, last point today, and this is a big one. It was a small thing, but the idea that the federal workforce or federal workers were
hacking.
Give it to him right in the neck.
I listened to Paul Ryan on Charlie Rose, and he talked about the unfair advantage that American businesses have when they're dealing with international business. They get taxed in the, by the country, taxed on the way out. That Trump
it's an unfair disadvantage.
Yeah, disadvantage. They want the Trump administration wants to take that away. Now, in my estimation, taking away revenue, that's essentially revenue to a lot of these, you know, to the federal government. What you're going to have to do is squeeze the government to make it more efficient or to limit expenses to make all that work. Is that what we're seeing here? Is it really less about I'm going to make the government work for you and more about I need to take that money and move it over here because we're taking money from taxes?
It's Grover Norquist's Grover Norquist, the conservative activist, had been saying literally for decades, we don't want to kill government. We want to make it small enough to drown it in a bathtub. This is why revenues have been, you know, they've been trying to squeeze the federal government. The fact is, to listen to them today, you'd think, oh my God, the federal government under Obama exploded in size. The fact is, it didn't happen at all. It was the smallest growth of the federal government under Obama than any White House in modern history.
That's my point. But it feels like more when we see when we're going to cut in areas or gut the Energy Department, things of that
nature. Under the rubric of respecting the taxpayer, I think what the federal government and what, you know, a high school district out in the west suburbs of the city of Chicago, what both of them owe their taxpayers is the statement that given our mission as constituted, right, we are delivering as efficiently as we possibly can. And we are constantly looking at what we're doing to make sure that we're being efficient. And if anybody in this world, and all of my Democrat friends agree with me when they're off the air about this, even maybe Dave Lundy, but if anybody out there thinks that the federal government under Bush or under Clinton or under Obama or under Bush or under Reagan is as efficient as American industry, or for that matter, you know, global players in German industry or global players in Japanese industry. If anybody thinks that HHS is as efficient as it possibly could be, then those people have got serious problems.
But I wonder, though, are we getting into the argument of the haves and the have-nots and the 1%? Because the companies that are going to get tax relief here to keep their companies here, the factories, they're not going to pay their fair share. So the question again becomes, What is this to somehow stimulate?
Why do you
the economy?
State that as a you're stating because, a conclusion
Paul
as
Ryan
a premise?
Said, no, but Paul Ryan said is that you know what government wants to do, what President Trump wants to do is get rid of the taxes for companies so they'll stay in America and not leave. And so my question is, that's a revenue stream, isn't it?
Wait. We have to look at the. I would say two quick points. Number one is you've got to look at the economy as a whole and the international economy as a whole, and you've got to look at what are our terms of trade with the rest of the world and what are the terms of the rest of the world with us. And the truth is we have the highest corporate tax burden of all industrialized nations. Now, people might say, let's ratchet that down, let's ratchet that up, whatever it is. But you got to start with an understanding that it is the highest tax burden in the industrialized world. That's number one. OK. And then number two, if government were just to stay the size that it is and Trump is successful in growing the economy as he says he wants to, then the size of government relative to the economy is going to reduce.
Yeah. Last word, Dave Lundy.
Well, first of all, what Chris just said about the corporate burden is a distortion of the facts, because the reality is that most corporations like GE, for example, don't actually pay their taxes and don't actually pay their fair share. They pay a teeny, teeny, tiny compared to what you and I and everybody in this room pays. But that's a story for another day because we are out of time.
Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling, Touche Monday nights here on The Download. Thanks, guys. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my guest tonight at the big table is one of the world's biggest authors, and she calls Chicago home. I'm talking about none other than Veronica Roth, who authored a Divergent series, that's Divergent, Insurgent, Allegiant, which were all made into blockbuster films. The young adult sci-fi writer is back with new work called Carve the Mark, It's a book that takes us to another galaxy, but really it's a story that defies its location. Children taken from one world, taught another, only to return. It's really about emotions, fear, pain, love, and belonging. And that's why this book's getting rave reviews. Veronica Roth grew up in Barrington, attended Northwestern University, and lives in Chicago. It's my pleasure to welcome her to the big table tonight. Veronica Roth, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
This is a great book. And an amazing, I have to ask, I mean, because I've heard this in interviews, that the really the bones of this story started when you were a little girl. Talk about that.
Yeah, so I don't know why 12-year-old Veronica wanted to write about kidnapping, but I was a little bit of a weird, dark child, I think, probably. but I have been trying to find the right setting and the right context for this story for a really long time. So I've written multiple versions of it. Some were fantasy, some were urban fantasy. This one was sci-fi, and it was the one that worked. So a long time coming, this story.
When you say that you wrote it when you're 12 years old, I mean, how much of it is it true to the original blueprint that you did back in those days?
Almost none of it, to be honest. Yeah, when I say I wrote it, I mean, I wrote like 35 pages and then I'd give up, and then I'd write 50 pages and I'd give up, you know, so I have all of them still. It's a little fun to go back and read them sometimes, but they really bear very little resemblance except to me, I think, the kind of heart of the story. It feels similar, but that's about it.
I kind of mentioned in the intro, just the idea that this story takes place in a faraway galaxy.
Yep.
Takes place in space. It's got all the sci-fi stuff that everybody expects. But it really is a story about emotion, whether it be the current gifts or the fates and everything in between. There seems to be a connection to the emotions that we all feel, but particularly that teenagers feel, whether it be pain, anxiety, love. Wanting to belong. I mean, is that the intention when setting this story to paper?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I say about teenagers a lot is that they have excellent BS detectors. You know, like, they're not here for your emotions that feel dishonest, for characters that don't feel real. Like, they'll call you out on the internet with gifs. And so really my aim is to be honest with the characters and their struggles, even if it's in a completely fictitious world where, you know, there's spaceships and special powers and all those things. So it's a focus of mine.
But I mean, not unlike Divergent. I mean, it's the same concept, dystopian Chicago replaced by, you know, the galaxy far away here. But the concept of digging in on the emotions that are involved. I mean, that seems to be what I pulled out of the book, was just this, like, one of the main characters, you know, her gift, or it's hard to explain, but the idea that, you know, pain was a big part of her life, was a big part of who she was. That seems to be almost part and parcel to what we learned from the heroine in the Divergent series about, you know, what anxiety and things like that are real emotions that are kind of attached to these heroines that are part of your stories.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's especially important now. I feel like what we're doing, I just want to say first that I love the internet in so many ways, like for the connection that it gives us to each other across space and time, and for like those like social systems you can find online. So I'm not like an anti-internet person, but I do think that people use it for good and for evil. And one of the like harmful ways that it's used is kind of a numbing thing, like a constant distraction. And really just people not delving into their emotional reality because they don't have to engage with those negative things. I feel myself doing it, too. And so
absolutely.
Through writing, I think I feel like I have a safe place because it's clearly not our world. It's not people I know. You know, there's a kind of like safe distance to really delve into those difficult and challenging parts of life.
Yeah, it is interesting because, you know, you feel that in the characters in this book. You feel that they can be, they're relatable beyond where they live or what galaxy they're from.
I hope so.
But, you know, I liked it and I really dug into it because I really did feel like I could take it out of this world and even apply it to the current situations that we're in. But what's first for you? Is it the story or is it the characters? What, as a writer, what do you start with when you start a book like Carve the Mark?
I definitely think I start with character, which is kind of inextricably tied to story because I have very specific opinions about history forming people and all. I think I explore those a lot with memory and in Divergent and in this book, too. So for me, it was Akos. Started with him. He's the, you know, the first main character that we meet. So It was his emotional struggle, kind of like you're pointing out, like he's taken from his family and he finds an affinity with the people who took him away, which I think is something that provokes guilt in him and a lot of fear and confusion and, you know, all these things that you experience, not just in adolescence, but throughout your entire life.
Right. Then there are the other siblings and then there's the other families. I mean, at what point do you start with the story and then add in the other characters?
Well, I think I just started with what I knew, which is that he's taken away from his home. That happens in the first 30 pages, so I feel like it's not a spoiler. So he's taken away from his home, and I just wrote up until that point. And then the real, like, difficult part started, because I'm like, well, what happens now? That's where the story kind of enters in, and where I just have to try things. So I really feel like I wrote this book, like, so many different, all the wrong ways, and then only just found the right way right before it had to be turned in.
At this stage of the game, I mean, after Divergent and all the success that you've had, I mean, is there a wrong way to write a Veronica Roth novel? I mean, I feel like, I don't know.
Write a bad one.
Yeah. How do you say, I mean, obviously, I mean, to be able, you've had experience now, you've had the, you know, the ability to create hits. Do you feel that? Do you feel that tension of trying to write the right way?
Yeah. I mean, I do. I feel the pressure. I feel all that. I mean, I think I'd have to be like a robot not to, with a book that kind of exploded unexpectedly the way that Divergent did. The question is always like, what am I going to do next? What do people expect? Like, I'm going to disappoint them. You know, I have this like constant fear. But I think the thing I try to keep in mind, which is, you know, humbling, is that just because a book is successful doesn't mean that it's excellent. And I am not trying to put down my own work, but I am saying that if you think of that as like a guarantee of quality, then you're going to be disappointed. So as a writer, you know, my goal is to keep getting better and never to think that I've arrived at some place or that my success was inevitable, because it wasn't. It was a timing thing.
Is that harder to do with successes? I mean, as a writer, I mean, I feel like we're jumping ahead, but I'm intrigued by the idea of starting new material with the world around you having such anticipation for it.
Well, I think one of the kind of skills that you try to learn the more books you write is just shutting people out for a long time, you know, until you really can't anymore. And I had to do that with Divergent, you know, just not with Divergent, but with Insurgent and Allegiant. Mm-hmm. And so, it was just a different form of doing that. Just like, you have to write the story, because, you know, if you think about other people while you're writing it, you'll never get it done. So I just pretend they don't exist.
Author Veronica Roth in studio with us. Her new book, Carve the Mark, is out now. Of course, she's the best-selling author of the Divergent series, Divergent, Insurgent, Allegiant, The Collection. There's a lot still to talk to Chicago author Veronica Roth here at the Big Table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin, my guest in studio at the Big Table, Chicago author Veronica Roth. She is the author of the best-selling series, the Divergent series, and of her new book, Carve the Mark, getting rave reviews, out now. Talk about your experience in writing. At 12 years old, I think about 12-year-olds, you know, maybe writing book reports or maybe writing short stories. What was it about your childhood that made you so creative?
I don't know. I mean, my mother is an artist, and she enrolled us in art classes and music and anything that we were interested in. So I think she fostered this kind of creative environment for us. And it was never, you know, don't pursue that. That's not practical. That wasn't a thing that she said. I mean, she did encourage us to be practical, but not at the expense of creativity. So I was just kind of free to do whatever I wanted. And I was definitely a child who played pretend, surprising no one. And then I had these like elaborate imaginary worlds, you know, and then when you get older, you don't play pretend anymore. It doesn't, like, that part of you kind of goes away. But I did start to channel it into writing, and we had this like very, very old Macintosh computer. Not the black and white one, but just after that, with the floppy disk drive.
Right.
And I had that in my room, and I would just write for hours and then occasionally take breaks to play SimCity of 2000. So I have very vivid memories of that time.
Did you identify, even as a young person, did you identify as a writer? Were you like, I'm going to be, or this is what I want to do? Or was it just a creative pursuit?
Yeah, no, I never thought about it actually working. I mean, I didn't think it would not work. I just didn't think about it. I would love to say that it was like this lifelong dream to get a book published, but I just didn't. That wasn't like the aim for me. It was something I really loved doing, and it wasn't until maybe college that I thought, like, oh, well, maybe I should try to get some of this published. I just, you know, I did it for me, and not for the result that would come of it, but just for the love of the process itself, which I think has been an asset since all this has happened. Because if you can love the process, then you can deal with a lot of failure and rejection and all those things.
Well, I mean, that's a great point. I mean, because you are, as you said, you have to shut the people out, and you have to make boundaries for you to be able to finish a book.
Yeah.
but talk about that idea of just trying to focus on being able to put out a story, something like Carve the Mark. I mean, what does it take for you to do that?
A lot of revision. So, and also, I feel cheesy saying this, but my mom always used to say, my mom, the like saint of my life, always used to say, just do the best you can. And so that was like my mantra through all of school. And then I really found myself relying on it, particularly here with Carve the Mark, because the pressure was kind of on, as we talked about earlier. But I just thought, like, okay, well, just make it as good as you can, and then you'll hit your maximum and your limit. And that's all you can do. I mean, you really, like, that's... people just have to accept that their best work is the best they can do. I mean, that sounds really obvious.
No, but I mean, there's something to be said about that. And it says people who strive for excellence in any form, how do you make sure you're doing the best you can? What are the things you put in to make sure that, yes, I'm doing my best?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's a good question, and certainly kind of difficult to answer. It requires more self-awareness than I probably have. But I think for me, it was a lot of patience and just being honest with myself. You know, I'd hit the end of a scene and I'd think, oh, I'm so tired. Like, I'm just so tired. I don't know if I can fix it. But, like, then I would think about, you know, when it's in print, having to live with it for the rest of my life, because that's essentially what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely right.
And so it's like, all right, I'm going to fix it. You know, I would find myself getting fatigued, you know, while writing the Divergent books. And, you know, most of the time I summoned the will to fix the problems I saw. But occasionally, you know, I just come up against a deadline and I'd have to let things go. And I just didn't want to do that here. It's like, no, I'm not letting a single thing go. We will get it out when it's perfect or nothing. Well, not perfect, but.
Veronica Roth is my guest at the big table tonight. Her new book, Carve the Mark, is out now. Of course, Veronica, best-selling author of the Divergent series. Both books, the Divergent series and those books and Carve the Mark, the characters are young.
Yes.
You write in a young adult genre. What drew you to that? I mean, to set, whether it be the heroine in Divergent at 16, 17 years old, what set, is it Syra? Is it
Syra, yeah, Syra. Good job.
But at 16, I mean, I couldn't, there were a lot of different ways to tell time in the book.
Oh, yeah.
But the
she's
point
about
being,
17,
yeah, but
yeah. Yeah,
the idea of setting these characters so young.
Well, to me, that time of life, it just has its own, like, huge drama, you know, and I don't mean, like, dramatic people. Like, I don't think that's exclusive to teenagers, but I mean, everything feels huge because it's the first time that you're exploring your adulthood and your freedom. So heartbreak is so much more intense because it's the first time you felt it. And so I gravitated toward the genre for that reason. I really loved reading when I was that age and reading about, you know, people who are experiencing like the same kind of emotional reality that I was. And then now it's sort of changed over the years. I mean, I still love the drama of adolescence, but I've met so many teenagers now, especially teenage girls. I think we are very quick to dismiss them as being like crazy or dramatic or shallow or, you know, all of those things. And really, that's not true of like most teenage girls. Yes, they will like freak out about, I don't know who, Justin Bieber or whatever, but they also will like read and come up with very thoughtful things to say. Like, I have seen them burst into tears from excitement and then like give me a letter that's super thoughtful, like within seconds of each other. Like, it's amazing. And so now that I've met more of these people, I'm just like, I have to write for you. Like, someone needs to speak to you. And there are so many excellent young adult books that are out there. And if I could just be one of them, that would be, you know, that's like my goal.
Well, what I love about Carve the Mark is it is a YA genre, and the characters are young. And there is drama, but the drama that you create around the characters is intense adult drama.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the idea. I mean, so it's almost like a double dose of drama.
Right.
In the way. So there is something that does, to see how your characters at such a young age have to react to things that most of us will never see. It's obviously fiction, but the idea that there is something pure in that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the specific story is universal in a way. You know, the more specific you get and the more real the story feels, the more people can relate to it just because we are all human and we understand and recognize humanity in other people. So, I mean, hopefully we do. That's kind of the point of fiction. But yeah, I mean, I don't think people are stop being teenagers, really. Like, if you think you are not living in middle school to a certain degree, you're lying to yourself.
Well, it's funny because you read this, and I read this as an adult, and at a certain point, the characters that we've mentioned, they don't necessarily live as teenagers to me.
No, I mean,
their age disappears.
I don't think, I mean, especially in this galaxy, they don't have, like, this concept of adolescence. And actually, the idea of adolescence is relatively new, like, historically speaking, because, you know, people used to get married when they were teenagers.
Yeah.
But as your lifespan, like, expands and as people become, like, better off and aren't starving as much, you create this, like, kind of concept of adolescence. So anyway, in Carve the Mark, that's not a thing that exists. Like, they have to be adults right away, pretty much.
Yeah, like, and I think that that's the movies might get in the way of that because those are teenage characters that you watch throughout the story and you're always sort of attracted to their physique, I mean, what they look like. In the book, your imagination takes you far away from that in the way that you're not thinking about this kid as a kid,
yeah,
especially what they have to deal with. So Veronica Roth is my guest tonight. She is the author of Carve the Mark. She's also the best-selling author of Divergent and of course Insurgent and Allegiant. We will continue the conversation. What I want to we'll hit the news. We come back. I'd love to talk about your relationship with the audience. You know, you've learned so much about teenagers. Maybe you can almost become an anthropologist in the way that you can tell us. So Veronica Roth, my guest tonight at the Big Table. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio, Veronica Roth, Chicago author, world-renowned Chicago author. She's done Divergent, and her new book, Carve the Mark, is out now. It's interesting because Chicago has such amazing literary talent. And
yes.
and you think about you know, anyone from Sarah Paretsky to the authors that have come through here and called Chicago home. To you, I mean, you live in Chicago, and a lot of people don't necessarily know that. You know, when you think about Divergent or Carve the Mark, why do you stay here? What is it about Chicago that keeps you as an author in this town?
I love it here, and if you get me started on this topic, I'll never shut up. But I've been to a lot of places. This place is special to me. It's beautiful, first of all, and I just love the people here. I mean, I think. First of all, Chicagoans love to hear about how great Chicago is,
yeah, right.
So I am not immune to that. Yeah. I just really love, like, there's no, like, attitude here. I feel like people just want to live here, and they're relatively good to each other. You know, like, I'm always watching people help each other shovel their cars out, and I feel like the snow is the great equalizer for us. But, you know, there's a sense of, like, just, like, regularness about being here, and I love that.
I remember this was a couple years ago. I was at Navy Pier, and it was a morning, and they were dressing up Navy Pier for, I think it was for Divergent.
Oh, yeah.
And they were dressing it up. And it was funny because you look up and you're like, oh, the Ferris wheel looks like it's
rusted.
Making it,
yeah.
Yeah, they're making it dystopian. And I remember knowing your story at that point and saying, gosh, she lives in Chicago. It must be crazy to think that they are transforming Chicago as we speak in her image, in the things that she's written about. I mean, what was it like to actually... to have the movies, we'll talk about the movies, but to have a movie actually shoot in Chicago and dress up landmarks after your work.
It was so incredibly sad when they moved production to Atlanta because, I mean, first of all, Atlanta does not look like Chicago.
No.
I love Atlanta, but no, it's not the same. But it was amazing when they shot Divergent here, mostly because just like how many people I met who were doing, you know, really specific kinds of work, like the big burly men who were creating the sets, like they would be like, can you sign a book for my daughter? Like, I can't believe you are like on this set right now. Anyway, and then I'd go on the L, you know, and I would have my little like security badge or whatever, and I'd walk onto the set and it's just like suddenly everything is different. You know, they put gravel everywhere, they'd cover up all the the store signs and all that, and it was suddenly like entering the future, and it was very strange, and I've never felt cooler than walking on that set.
Let's talk about the movies real quick. I think it's interesting because your books are very descriptive, and they are very, I mean, like we talked about, they're character based. There's a lot. I mean, it's just the nature of writing, you know, a novel. I mean, you're in an area in which you have to explain where you're at.
Yeah.
Movies and scripts will take shortcuts. They will tighten the plot. They'll change the plot. They'll move things around. They'll gloss over a lot of things that you took 2 pages to.
Yeah.
So talk about that relationship. How do you feel about the idea? I mean, it's obviously a positive story for have the Divergent series go on to such success in the movie realm. It's great for you. But as a writer, that transition from book to screenplay, how did that transpire?
Well, it was weird, and I never knew what to expect exactly, because just because you sell rights doesn't mean they're going to make the movie. So I was pessimistic for a really long time, because that's my official life strategy. It's just defensive pessimism. I'm like, it's not going to happen. It wasn't until they cast Kate Winslet that I was like, oh, yeah, probably going to happen. Hmm. Because, you know, you don't do that unless
you
actually...
Yeah, you don't waste your time. Right.
So that was really bizarre. I try very hard not to be precious about my work, and so I was perfectly happy to see it changed as long as it served the story in its new format and its new medium. I really feel like the first movie in particular did a great job of that kind of streamlining, but without losing the kind of like heart and fun of the story. So I liked that one in particular, especially because, you know, it was in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I'm biased. But... Yeah, so it's difficult, though, because then as the movies continued, they deviated more and more from the plot, and not always in ways that I felt like were to the benefit of the movies.
Do you get a chance to give them feedback on the scripts? Yeah, you did.
I did, but they don't have to listen to it. You know, it's like there's like 100 voices all shouting at the same time, and I'm just one of them. So, you know, it was difficult, but at the same time, like, who's going to complain if they make a movie of your book? Like, that's ridiculous. I mean, it was amazing to see.
But there's got to be some. I mean, you had such success with Divergent. That helps in the way that, you know, the next books are coming out. But there has to be some anxiety as a writer.
Oh, yeah.
To say, oh, geez, I hope they don't make, you know, off the top of my head, I can't think of what a bad movie would be. But I hope they don't make a bad movie.
Yeah, I mean, there definitely is. Like, you want it to be good because,
right.
And that's a thing, like, if they change the story and it makes a good movie, it doesn't really matter, you know, like, because the book is still, you can't change the book. The book is out. So nothing that they can make it into takes away from that. But if it's not a great movie, then it's just kind of like, ugh, but why?
Veronica Roth is my guest in studio tonight here on 720 WGN. We had an author on, he's a TV writer. And he said, and he does Goliath, which just won the Golden Globe, and he was talking about how he was writing a new set of a trilogy or a novels. And he said that in Hollywood, what's happening is there's a change. There's a change in which the original screenplay is going away and the adapted screenplay is coming in.
Yeah.
If you want to get anywhere in Hollywood, write a book. That was the idea.
That's so weird.
It is weird. But I think about it, and you're like, well, a lot of the successful projects that Hollywood has taken on in the last, including your work, has been adapted from books. Do you think about the relationship as you move forward with success in both areas as a writer and as, you know, having it adapted and having the rights turn into such successful franchise? When you write Carve the Mark, are you thinking about, well, this could be a movie?
No. I mean, it's not that it had never occurred to me, but I really tried not to think about it. I think because I love books. I love them for what they are. I don't care about movies as much. I think movies are cool, and I certainly love going to them, but it's just not where my real love is. So I think about the book and making the best book I can, because they seem very similar, you know, movie, because they're both ways of storytelling.
Sure.
But they're not. You know, there's things you can do in books that you can't do in movies and vice versa. So I try to just focus on what's in front of me.
It is interesting because we talked right before the news just about the relationship to your audience. I mean, as in the YA genre, you are writing stories for young adults. They have responded in tremendous, tremendous fashion. You were very successful because of your audience.
Mm-hmm.
And you've talked to them in their spaces. I mean, you have had your own blog for years, but also a Tumblr now.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's a big part. I mean, talk about that relationship with that audience and what it means to you to have almost this strange direct pipeline to young America.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's like so new that just being able to access authors on social media is bizarre to me. Like, I wrote a letter to Lois Lowry when I was a kid. I think. Yeah, maybe I didn't even think about her as a human. Like, I just thought of her book, right? But now you can access pretty much anyone. So it's good and it's bad.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's probably challenges to that, right?
Definitely. You know, being on the internet is, like, it's an intense place for a lot of people. And when you do risky things with your books, then people will yell at you. And boy, did they yell at me. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, because of the way I ended the series. Yeah. I'm not going to say. But,
right,
you know,
right.
I think I broke some hearts, young hearts.
I will say that when we put on the, that you were coming in, one of our program directors was like, oh, I've got a question about the end. I was like, all right, we'll get to that later.
Yeah.
But I mean, that is a great point, that there are pros and cons to the relationships where they can voice their opinion of what they think of your work in almost real time.
Yeah, but you just kind of learn how to deal with it. And especially because, like, what happened with Allegiant was I got all that, like, very angry reaction. But then I got one letter from this girl who had lost her father the year before. And she, I don't know, she's maybe 17, which is just, like, really sad. But also she was like, well, I just loved seeing death treated as, like, a real thing. And it meant a lot to me. And I was like, well, that just made it all worth it. Like, it's weird how that can happen. But I was just like, I just suddenly don't mind all the anger because, like, this one girl somewhere made her feel better. I don't know. That sounds cheesy, but it was real.
I think that a lot of authors, regardless of the genre that they work in, would long for that relationship, to have that immediate relationship and have the stories both ways. I mean, it can all be good.
Yeah, no. And also, like, when people are angry at you, it means they're enthusiastic about it. Like, they're so into it. It's so real to them that they are, like, pissed off and are going to find you on the internet. And really, like, I'm not here to complain about that. Like, I don't know. I also do a lot of school visits, and I've been to a juvenile detention center, and I find that connection really valuable, too. Like, people ask me if I'm going to write for adults ever, and really, I, you know, who knows the future, but I would be so sad to lose the connection to teachers and librarians and to people who are really, like, doing good work with young people, which I think is, like, so important. So there's a kind of
fulfilling part of
a new part I didn't think about when I was writing. I didn't think I'd go to schools or that I would like it because it's kind of an intense environment. But I do. I mean, I do.
Yeah. The question I was going to ask was, you know, this book is in the same lane as Divergent, Carve the Mark. It's, you know, and it was widely anticipated. I have to say, I mean, it's very interesting the way that the publishing company was like, here comes the next Veronica Roth. You know, your audience has done countdowns. Tons of pinned tweets. It's just kids everywhere ready for her. I mean, how does that feel for you? I mean, the idea that there is this anticipation, does that at all stifle you creatively to say, you know what, this next one's a Western? Like, I mean, do you feel like you're kind of tied to the, I don't want to say dystopian, but the sci-fi YA genre?
No, because I think most of the time when people have big success, they go do something completely different for exactly the reason that you just described, which is like, oh God, I got to get away. And I feel ridiculous even saying her name in the same breath as anything of mine. But, you know, J.K. Rowling, for example, did Harry Potter, and then the next thing was like a little kind of cozy adult book. And then it was Galbraith and like crime. Like, she's just doing everything, which I think is totally fine. And if I were the author of Harry Potter, I probably would do the same thing. But, you know, I had much less success than that, but like still a great amount. Thanks, guys. And I just couldn't, like, deviate that much. I'm not interested in other kinds of stories. I love sci-fi, and I just wanted to do something I really felt a lot of joy in. So I think people find that joy in different places, but for me, it was here.
Well, it's bringing a lot of joy to the readers. Veronica Roth, the author of Carve the Mark, also the best-selling author of the Divergent series, Chicago author, grew up in Barrington. Can't thank you enough for sitting down at the big table tonight.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Awesome to have Veronica Roth here. How great is that, man? She is. I mean, it's amazing to think about the fact that she, as a young adult author, I mean, I'm trying to think of who, I don't really know who wrote The Hunger Games. Maybe that. John Green, another friend of ours, has been on the program, another young adult star. But Veronica Roth is up there, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if we read in, you know, Variety or Hollywood Deadline reporter in 2 days that Carve the Mark has been optioned for film and it'll be the next one starring Kristen Stewart. She'll be like, no, I'm in a galaxy. It's a really good book. It's the idea that each person on this planet that the book surrounds has a gift. And, you know, it could be anything from being able to tell the future to being able to one of the main characters, her gift, which is terrible, was actually negative in the sense that she just always felt pain.
Ew.
Yeah, and then but then the sort of love interest in the book, the guy's gift is he could remove pain. So it was interesting like that. Like there's a gift, and if you could tell the future, you were in high demand. Everybody wanted those kids, so you had to keep it secret, and then it was revealed, and it became like a big. That's what the book's about. So.
When you were reading it, did you? You said Kristen Stewart. Did you picture these characters as like a, what was yeah, this right. a Jennifer Lawrence right. Character? Or?
I didn't. I just pictured everybody being like 70. I think that was the thing. I was just like, I know it was a young adult book, but I wanted everyone to be like senior citizens. No. I didn't really, that's a good point. I didn't think of it as like who the celebrities are. But, yeah. It was a good book. Veronica Roth. I'm glad to, she was a long time coming on her. She's one of those that we talked about.
Yeah.
That I have been bothering publishers, and Pete's been bothering publishers to get Veronica in studio for, geez, a year?
Yeah.
A year plus?
At least.
All right. We're doing it.
Cross another one off the list.
Yes. All right. Coming up, Austin Baker's going to join us. He is the restaurateur behind One Fun and Two Fun Chinese in the West Loop. Brand new restaurant bringing Sichuan cuisine to Chicago. It's already here, but he's bringing it to the West Loop. Chinese New Year's this weekend. We'll talk to Austin about essentially what he and his restaurant group and his chefs and everybody did. They went to China on an excursion to get more familiar with the flavors and the spices and the cuisine that is in the Sichuan province. And I think I think you're seeing more and more of that when someone wants to launch a restaurant, especially in a specific kind of food, they go and immerse themselves in that culture for for an amount of time. I don't know how long he was out there, but the point being that they want to have an understanding of what they're getting into. So we'll talk about what makes that cuisine. I went to the restaurant. I even talked with Adasha last week. I love that restaurant. It was great. So finally, Austin going to be in studio. We'll talk about what makes the flavors. Because what I really liked about it, and when you think about like a dish that's like Kung Pao chicken, and everybody knows that dish, right? It can be spicy, and it's sort of blended with the peanuts and the chicken, things like that. But it's also that thing where you're like, you eat it and you're like, it's just so hot, hot. They put little red flames next to it on the menu at the big bowl or whatever, hot, hot, hot. But what I loved about One Fun is, and we're going to talk about this, is that there is there's a concerted balance of that spiciness. So automatically you're like, this is hot. But then with the other flavor that they use, like almost battle in your mouth to be like, it's not hot. Like they put out the fire. It's pretty intense. And I really enjoyed like the construction of that kind of a spicy dish like that. So we'll talk with Austin Baker coming up. Also, the Purcells, indie rock here in Chicago, a new album out. They're going to be in live for Studio 435. That's all coming up tonight. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up in the 10 o'clock hour, the Purcells live indie rock studio 435. We do it every Monday night. The studio is already sort of ripped up. We got the drum kit in place. It's going to be a fun 10 o'clock hour, studio 435. The Purcells, they're coming up. They're playing at Shuba's coming up on Feb 3rd. Well, this Saturday is the Chinese New Year. It's going to be celebrated all over the city, but this year it'll also be celebrated at the restaurant in the West Loop. One Fun Chinese and Two Fun Chinese bring Sichuan cuisine to the West Loop, Randolph Street. But One Fun's not your typical Chinese restaurant. It's the newest restaurant from Austin Baker and his partner chef, Ben Ruiz. Baker is no stranger to the city's culinary scene. He was a part of the Hog Salt family and helped open the famed Au Cheval, as well as his own restaurant, the critically acclaimed Bar Marta in Humboldt Park. But One Fun and Two Fun Chinese, yep, two restaurants in the building, are a departure for Baker, and he joins me in studio tonight. Austin Baker, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I've been talking about your restaurant for about a week and a half now. I loved it. I thought it was great. And what I really loved about it, I talked about right before the news, was just the fact that you seem to be bringing a different type of Szechuan food to Chicago. Explain the concept behind this restaurant.
Sure. So One Fun Chinese is a Szechuan restaurant. Two Fun is more the cocktail lounge above it. We tried to focus on what we experienced when we were in Szechuan, in Chengdu, primarily in China. And what we found was a lot of Szechuan restaurants, especially people who are opening them like us, were focusing on just the spiciness of it. And when we were in Chengdu...
Is that what's usually when you think of Szechuan food in Chicago? Yeah. You just think spicy.
Even Chinese people in other parts of China are like, oh man, you're going to Chengdu. It's going to be so spicy. It's too spicy.
Too spicy.
It's too spicy. People in Beijing are like, it's too spicy. And okay, so we went there and it was really about eating and it was about balance. So that's kind of...
What do you mean by balance?
It's not just spicy. So there's something called mala there where it's a term that means spicy and numbing. So the Szechuan peppercorn is a different type of spiciness that numbs your mouth. So that coupled with the traditional chili, which actually comes from the Americas, gives you this mala, what they call mala reaction. And it's both those. And it's a balance of that. And it's not just that. So a lot of people have come back and taken that to the extreme. We tried to balance that as what we saw there. It's supposed to be enjoyable.
Yeah.
It's not just supposed to rip your face off. There are dishes that are hotter than other dishes.
It's interesting because balance is such a big, and it's a big part of Chinese culture and Asian culture as well. But this concept of what we have stripped away from it and brought to the Americas, where we're like, they got this thing that makes it really hot. Make it as hot as possible.
Sure.
But that's really not at the center of Szechuan food.
Right. No. To me, in Chengdu, it was about eating and living. And that whole premise of life was what really drew us to it. And the flavors are very complex and delicious and balanced again, but it's so much more deep than just being spicy. Mm-hmm. It's much more than that.
When you, I mean, talk about, you opened Bar Marta, Au Cheval. I mean, those, there's once a sort of a French bistro. The other, what would you say is Bar Marta? That's a
neighborhood Italian-American. Yeah.
I mean, but in both cases, you're not necessarily going to Paris to check out the bistro, or maybe to Rome to get an Italian feel for it. Talk about how important it is for you to be one with the culture that you are serving when you talk about the cuisine that you're serving.
Sure. Well, anytime we open a restaurant, and especially something as different and as foreign to us as Chinese. I've been cooking Italian and French food my whole life, for the past 15 years. So opening Bar Marta is very comforting and recognizable for me. And opening One Fun and Two Fun Chinese was completely different. And that's exactly why we did it. We didn't want to open another restaurant that there's an abundance of in Chicago.
Right, right.
We wanted to do something different. So it was extremely important in this instance and in every other instance, but really in this one to go there and see it. And, you know, that's a long ways to go. And we spent a lot of time there. We went to the Culinary Institute, but it was really necessary. Like, and it's necessary for us to go back and to continue to pursue the cuisine. We've only scratched the surface.
I'm talking with Austin Baker, his restaurant, One Fun and Two Fun Chinese, both in the West Loop and Randolph, right at Randolph and, was it Peoria?
Yeah.
It's right, yeah, right at Graziano's, right next to Graziano's, the great deli right there. You know, I mentioned in the lead, you've had such a great run here in Chicago, whether Bar Marta, but also Au Cheval opening with Hog Salt. What have you learned from those experiences? Because Au Cheval is considered in Chicago to be one of the restaurants in which, you know, I mean, 3-hour waits, 4-hour waits, a cheeseburger everybody talks about around the country. I mean, what do you learn from working in that environment that you take with you?
I mean, I learned a lot from Hog Salt and Brendan, the business side of it. Before that, I was in Asia working in a small resort, very high-end resort. Before that, I was in a very fancy French restaurant, Le Bernardin, for 3 years and in New York. And those were all places.
Famous restaurant, yeah.
Yeah, great place. Awesome experience. And that's where I learned how to sharpen my knives and how to cook and how to be clean and efficient and flavors. And Hog Salt taught me how to translate that all to people and how to be a successful business.
How so, when you say to translate that to people? I mean, what is it about, and I don't want to spend too much time on Au Cheval, but I mean, what is it about an experience that has a restaurant, for people who are listening right now who haven't had the experience to go to a restaurant, for them to go, it's a 3-hour wait. It's
right.
Ridiculous. But like, what is it that people will go, okay, put my name on the list.
I think it's a 3-hour wait because it touches on a memory and it touches on something that's recognizable. And I think it's the same at Wanfun. It's a wait because it's Chinese food that it's a smaller group of people who've had it, but once they've had it, they want it again. And when I grew up in Iowa, we had this place called the Egg Roll House, and I will never forget those egg rolls. They were actually still some of the best egg rolls I've ever had. And there's a reason why there's these amazing Chinese restaurants spread all across the U.S. There's a long history in it. And I think whatever you – if you can open a restaurant that touches on people's past and their memories, you're going to be okay.
For you, you had kind of a traditional, if you will, sort of ascension in the business. You talked about working in the resort or working in New York City, but you've gone from, you know, being the chef to now you're talking about, okay, I'm learning the business side. You know, I'm at my own restaurant in Humboldt Park. Now I'm back on in the West Loop where all the action's at. Which is there a part of the business that you prefer over the others? I mean, would you be content with saying, all right, you know what, just set me up, put the orders in front of me and let me cook?
Yeah.
Or are you the kind of guy that's like, no, I like going out to the tables. I like...
I go back and forth. You know, like, last weekend, we were... Chef Ben was out doing an event, and so I got to expo, and we were so busy. He was down prepping, and I got to stay up and expedite. And at the end of the night, I was like, I haven't been that happy in a long time. That felt really good.
It's good to jump in for
and
one night,
we don't
right?
do anything else and just do these two. It's really the interaction with the guests, and that's what's great about Wanfun. It's an open kitchen, so you're right there. You're running food to the guests and seeing their reaction and seeing if they're happy or not. And all your hard work kind of pays off in that moment. And I guess that's why I do it.
You know, for you at Wanfun, one of the things I really liked about it is the service was, and this is something we've talked about on the show, just about how we've seen a little bit of a dwindling in the way that service is done. But your servers have a task. And the task is to explain Szechuan food in a way that you want them to consume it. Because I could easily look at your menu and see a Kung Pao chicken, see a fried rice, see, you know, some sort of fish thing, and be like, yeah, you know what? I know what I'm doing. I love the Kung Pao. But the server was more about sort of expanding. I mean, how important is it for you guys to tell the story of your restaurant through your servers when people come in?
It's important to a point. Like, we do want to educate, but we also... We don't want that to impede on just having a good time. If you want to come in and just get, you know, spring rolls and a fried rice, and absolutely. Like, if you're happy with that, we're happy with that. If you want to dive a little deeper, we're here for you. Like, I think that's my stance on it.
That's your stance on it?
Yeah.
Austin Baker, my guest. We're talking about Wanfun Chinese, Tufun Chinese, both in the West Loop on top of each other. Tufun is the cocktail bar. Wanfun is the restaurant at Randolph and Peoria in the West Loop, right next to Graziano's. You know, I'm interested in what you guys are going to do for Chinese New Year. I mean, this is new for you. I mean, this is like we talked about. I mean, you spent time in Asia. How much from working in resorts, you know, and working in just Asian culture, are you leaning on for your experience to deliver Szechuan food in Chicago?
Very little. I mean,
really?
Yeah. My time in Asia was in Bhutan, small hamlet of a country in the Himalayas, and I worked at a very fancy resort. And there's definitely some crossover in the style of food and a lot of dumpling making there. But what we're doing is, and what Ben is doing is, it's very much different than what I was doing in Bhutan. Culturally, there's some realizations that I made there, I'd say. But that probably affects me more as an individual than it does really the food. Chinese New Year's, yeah, I mean, it's we're pulling on a lot of traditional things. We're doing some fun stuff with red envelopes and satsumas, and the night of, we're having a pretty big party upstairs. The details
are... What are the details? They're
kind of underground.
It's underground.
Yeah, we can't...
That's right. Only for you on the blowtorch 50,000-watt radio station do you get the information. No, but I mean, what I... Do you feel like there is more of a responsibility for you to get Chinese New Year's right, you know, to not sort of bastardize it and make it sort of an American thing where we're having a party and we got red envelopes, but the music's kicking in, it's not the same, this is just a party? Or are you the kind of guy from your experience of going to the Sichuan province and experiencing Chinese culture that you feel like you want to make it authentic?
We definitely want to make the food as authentic as we can, and kind of educate people that way. I don't think I'm too worried about making New Year's that authentic. It's a celebration, just like our New Year's.
Just a celebration.
It's actually a better celebration. They do it for 2 weeks traditionally. Nowadays, they only really take a week off.
See, that's where you got to do 2 weeks.
Yeah, I'd love to take a 2 week party. We pull on some of the traditional things. We'll have a DJ and have a good party upstairs, and we'll adjust some of the menu downstairs to fit for Chinese New Year's.
You know, I was reading some stories that were put together when the restaurant launched in November, and there was, you know, there seemed to be at least some interest paid to authenticity. The idea of this is the Sichuan province, is this authentic Sichuan food. And you talk a little bit about the idea of blending it. The idea of there is this authentic food, but it's also being met with some great chefs here in Chicago and yourself, sure, like to change it up. Talk about that process of learning what the authentic food is and twisting it.
Yeah, that's, I think, the most important part first is learning the authentic version, going and trying the authentic version, seeing what it's like, and then the other half of it is learning what your consumer base wants and finding that middle ground. Or sometimes it's not a middle. Some dishes don't change at all and they're super authentic and they offend some people, and other people just sometimes I'm surprised. Like, for instance, the mouth-watering rabbit, it's pretty traditional, it's pretty close to what we had, and I didn't think people would like it here, and they love it, and everybody orders it, and it's very mouth-numbing. It literally makes your mouth water. It has a lot of that Sichuan peppercorn, and it's a chilled pulled rabbit salad. Didn't expect that. Didn't think that people would like it. Pretty traditional dish. But then there's things like the Chongqing fried chicken, where in China, Chongqing is a city close to Chengdu. It used to be part of Sichuan province. Now they split it apart because it's a lot of people. That dish, flavor-wise, we're pretty close to what we had in China, but we don't chop our chicken up really small with the bones in it. We leave it whole like an American style fried chicken. To me, the whole debate about authenticity, it's a very, I love talking about it, but it's not the end all be all. Like, cuisine isn't stuck. It shouldn't be stuck. It's always changing. Sichuan cuisine is only 300 years old. They didn't have chilies until Columbus brought them from America. So how authentic can it be? How far back do we go?
Right.
And have this conversation. Like, if we go too far back, it doesn't exist.
That's a great point. For you to come back to the West Loop, to open in the West Loop right there, I mean, it's amazing for people, diners who are listening right now, or people don't know, Randolph Street at Halsted, between Halsted and now it seems like Racine, has just exploded in the last 5 years, where you've had restaurants, like we mentioned, Au Cheval, and now, you know, Rick Bayless just moved in.
Yeah.
Stephanie Eisard and her restaurants are in that area. The Nobu Hotel, or Nobu and the hotel every time you blink your eye, there's some sort of construction.
Yeah. What's it?
Yeah, here comes the McDonald's headquarters. I mean, for you to be a part, do you like to be a part of that epicenter, or are you more of a guy who's like, you know what, I like where I like being in Humboldt Park, I like being off the beaten track. Which do you prefer?
I like both. I love it after getting like absolutely annihilated at One Fun, and then like going to my little like cave at Bar Marta and enjoying an amazing pork chop and a glass of wine. And yeah, I like both. I don't really pay much attention to what's going around me. I mean, don't get me wrong, I understand, like, McDonald's is going up and, like, there's condos and there's cranes all over the place, but I don't really care where I am as long as there's people to come and eat the food and enjoy it, and it seems like both locations that's the case.
Austin Baker is the man behind the new restaurants, One Fun Chinese and Two Fun Chinese, the cocktail bar, him and his partner Ben Ruiz. He's also the man behind Bar Marta, and he also was involved with Hog Salt in opening Au Cheval. Austin, thanks so much for coming in. You got the big Chinese New Year celebration on Saturday. That's going to be at Two Fun, both places, right?
Friday and Saturday.
Friday and Saturday. Check it out. Austin, thanks so much for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
My favorite news, WGN Morning News. I don't think there's another show, I think we talked about this before, that I watch every single day. I got maybe ESPN a little bit, like I try to watch it, but it just gets mind-numbing. But I watch WGN Morning News like every day. There you go. That was my endorsement of our sister station.
Yeah, it's a great show.
Yeah. Awesome to have Austin Baker. I'm telling you, Pete, I'm going to take you over there, man.
All right.
Do you like Chinese food like that?
I do.
There's a lot of vegetarian options. And I'm not usually, and we have a lot of chefs in here, right? I mean, that's one of the things we've done a lot. And a lot of places I've been, I've talked on this show with a lot of James Beard winners and, you know, had the chance to go to some great restaurants. But that restaurant, what I really liked about it is you can tell his influence on places like Au Cheval or Bar Marta, which are great restaurants, and Au Cheval being one of the best maybe ever in Chicago history at this point, you know, that continues to have lines out the door. You can taste that same influence, you know, in the Szechuan food that he's doing. Like, automatically, I was like, I taste that, I'm like, oh, that, whatever that is, he's right, whatever that memory, like, whatever that is that he has, like, found a way to completely connect with my taste buds.
Huh.
And there's great restaurants in town that do that, but this is where I'm just like, wow.
We kind of shy away from Randolph in that we're intimidated, mm-hmm. because we, you know, they're the best restaurants. Some of the best restaurants in the city are there. And like, we went to Bad Hunter,
yeah,
which
just
opened.
Right.
And you know, it's like we went like 3 months before it opened, you know, try to make a reservation. Yeah. We have 3:30 and 12.
Come on, man.
It's like, oh my God. Or, you know, so
yeah,
I mean,
right,
like,
right.
If, you know, if he can, you can hook me up at the.
Well, he was just in here, just walked out. Why don't you grab him and be like, hey, man, can I get one, two for Thursday at 7 o'clock? Yeah, I mean, we can't. I mean, yeah, let's use some of that muscle, some of that GN download muscle.
Will he shame me if I am not very good with my chopsticks?
Oh my God, I was terrible. It's funny. My wife and I are both in there, and I knew she was having problems. I'm like, can we get a fork over here? Can we get a couple forks? They'll give you forks too. But I pretended.
Oh,
the
yeah.
whole time I pretended.
Yeah,
I'm a pretender.
You have to pretend.
Yeah, I was just like, oh yeah, look at this, look at me. Oh, I'm gonna reach across and grab that piece of chicken with these chopsticks. As one of the chopsticks just goes in the chicken, I'm like, oh, that, you know what? That's that one.
I like what they do with the kids when they roll up that piece of paper and then put a rubber band around it.
Yeah,
to help you know, it gives you like a little like spring action at the top there.
There you go. See, that's what you need to do.
I'm not sure what looks dorkier, that or just using the fork.
I always ask, what's the biggest thing on the menu? Like, no rice. I'm not going to be dealing with trying to pick up any rice.
See,
with these
that's
sticks.
What I did. I was like, I got the fried rice and I was eating it with the chopsticks. And there were like six times in a row there was no food. By the time it got to my mouth, there was no food. So, yeah. Thank you, Rob. Crystal Lake is the next stop on the WGN Radio Hometown Voices Tour presented by Allstate. Join me for a live broadcast of the download this Wednesday night, January 25th from 7 to 10 at Duke's Ale House in Crystal Lake. Get through that midweek slump by spending the evening with us. Enjoy Duke's gourmet comfort foods. Enter a chance to win restaurant gift certificates and ski lift passes to Wilmot Mountain. Wilmot. That's how you say it in Chicago. Wilmot. Hey, you going to Wilmot? Visit the events page at WGNRadio.com for details. The WGN Radio Hometown Voices Tour presented by Allstate Chicago's Own Good Hands. Looking forward to it. Got a great lineup. We're going to be at Duke 7-10. Jack Franks, the McHenry County Board Chairman, will be there. It'll be good to talk to him because, you know, he is he was on the show. We did a big big table with him not too long ago. But, you know, he was really an ardent no tax hike Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of stood in the way of Mike Madigan and the push in Springfield to, you know, he essentially, Jack Franks and maybe a couple others, took away this sort of famed supermajority that Mike Madigan had. And so I'm sure, in many ways, you know, Mike Madigan's glad to see Jack Franks go. But it'll be interesting because it's the state of the state is Wednesday, and Governor Rauner will be, so it'll be interesting to talk with Jack Franks without sort of his hat as being a Democratic House member. You know what I mean? To say, kind of give us an inside look at what's happening there without actually having to worry about his boss being mad at him, right? It's simple, right? But I'm sure he has a lot to gain, lose with the McHenry County board chairs as well. But we'll talk with him. It'd be fun to talk to him because I do think it's amazing to think about. I've been seeing a lot of rhetoric online about balancing the budget and what's going to happen when they talk about this sort of quote-unquote tax. There's a floated in the Senate plan, which was kind of shelved, but it could be the basis of what the tax plan is moving forward. They're talking about a tremendous increase, like 30-40% on the income tax. So for someone who makes $50,000, I read it's something like $600-700 a year. So just get it, you know, you got to understand what's at stake. But it's interesting that, you know, this is something that I don't think that Governor Rauner has shied away from. Meaning, you know, this is something, if this is on the table, then some of his reforms can go through. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to figure that out. That's why they keep saying, is it the Rauner tax? Is it the, you know, the Mike Madigan tax? So that's what's going to come out in a session. And what I also think is really interesting is it's part and parcel with this idea of a property tax freeze. Because essentially, you know, they don't want to be able to jack your property taxes up locally if the state's going to jack you up regionally, you know, at the state level. So you can understand now as you see the sort of wheels move in motion when it comes to the taxing bodies and how, you know, Rauner wants to protect people in a way because he knows that he's going to tax. It'd be interesting to talk with Jack in the situation he's in now because the property tax increase or property tax freeze and an income tax increase for counties like McHenry County, Lake County, Will County. It's a different game when there isn't the sort of downtown industry that can, you know, take the brunt of taxing. McHenry County, some of the taxes for property taxes alone, that's how they make their money. That's how the government works out there. So you're talking about thousands of dollars for property tax. That's difficult, especially when your property value decreases. And so that's what we'll talk with Chairman Franks at Duke's, you know, with some beer and some sandwiches in the background. Good conversation. Also, my buddy Stu McVicker is going to be there. Stu, of course, has the man cave, the Cubs man cave. You've seen him all over. We talked about this on Friday, but he is all over media. Dude is like, when it's Cubs season, he is the darling. They go to it. I think that he's even getting national media. And then he created this Cubs man cave in his basement, which is much more like a shrine or a museum. I went and saw it. I thought man cave would be a couple couches and, ooh, hey, open up that cooler right there. Bud Light, bro. Like, that's what I thought it would be. When I went down, there's a full bar. There's like a screen. There's replicas of Wrigley Field. There's memorabilia everywhere. It's tricked out.
Yeah.
And so now he has fundraisers. You know, former players, current players come out for their charities, and they have big parties in his backyard, and you can sign autographs, things like that. And so we'll talk to Stu about that because he's sort of become like almost Cub royalty. I mean, really?
Yeah, for sure. He was all over the place during the World Series run.
Yeah. There you go. So he'll come out. I did talk to Johnny Hansen, who's the triple... You know, me, Stu, and Johnny. And Johnny's in Houston. And he can't make it back up. I was like, come on, dude. You ain't got a Southwest down there? You got a plane? You can stay here at the studio.
Oh man, no more. So no reunion of.
I feel like I've done a good job with social media and whatever to be able to say, yo, you should come out and check out this show. You know, like a lot of people from high school. Because if you're just joining, I went to high school in McHenry. I went to McHenry West in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. And Crystal Lake is sort of that's where we're going. It's sort of the hub of, that's where you went. You really wanted to be cool. You went to Crystal Lake. I actually grew up in Wonder Lake, Illinois. So you would go to high school in McHenry, and it'd be funny. You'd be like, this is so cool. What a cool town. But then all the people in McHenry are like, you're lame. Crystal Lake's the town to be in. So once you got older and you got a little wiser, you went to Crystal Lake. Then you'd be like, you know where the cool party's at? Barrington.
Oh,
if you can
yeah.
make it up to Barrington mm-hmm. or that way. And then you move to the city. That's usually the trek in which you go. But Crystal Lake is, that's kind of a go-to. So we have 2 days to get together our Crystal Lake trivia. Because I feel like that's something that we need to pull out. You know, at Duke's.
Yeah, we can go deep.
I got Crystal Point Mall. You know, like I said, I would give a Wilmot Mountain pass to anyone who could name all the stores that were in the Crystal Point Mall. The only problem is I don't know the answer, so you could just be fibbing it.
You can probably find like an image.
Yeah.
Or say like, you know, like between the Kohl's and the Sears on the the one
Crystal
tier.
Point though was the mall that almost was established before the real malls. So it was like just one walkway. It wasn't even like they hadn't figured out the quad style yet, like Woodfield. Or you know where you would go is to the one in Vernon Hills. That was like, I forgot the name of it, but that was the one that you would go to. Hawthorne?
Mm-hmm.
You go to Hawthorne. That's where you, the real mall experience, or Woodfield. But that's, Woodfield was like a city. You go to Hawthorne, you're like, oh yeah, they got a Nordstrom's, and they got a Macy's, and they got a JCPenney. And Crystal Point Mall, you had one lane.
Oh,
and
that's
we
it.
Had one side was like the Sears, and then the other side was the JCPenney, and you would just walk from one to the other.
Well, maybe you could do like, if you could think of 10 stores that are no longer around, you got your Baker's, you got your Casual Corner.
Right.
You got
Zayers.
Zayers.
I feel like Zayers was in that mall. I can't. I mean, I remember
your
going there.
Your KB Toys.
Yeah, right. There was probably a KB Toys type store. My ear, nose, and throat doctor was in Crystal Lake. I do remember that because we'd have to take like
fancy.
A 30. Yeah. Because when I was growing up, I had like curved ear canals. So I was a kid who they would try like the new machine. Have you ever had the machine done on your ears?
Mm-mm.
Where they would like suck out earwax? If anyone has had that happen in the listening audience, you know the feeling. It's essentially like, it's a big thing. If you go to ear, nose, and throat and you have like a plugged up ear,
mm-hmm.
it's too much earwax. Instead of doing like the old syringe with water and like dumping it out, they have a machine. And they'd be like, and they turn it on like, boom.
It just feels amazing. You can feel everything.
It doesn't feel amazing.
Oh, it doesn't?
It gives you that Darth Vader feel where you can hear yourself breathe when you're done. But the problem was is that, you know, you go in there, and if it hits something, like, you know, like if you had like a hard piece of wax or whatever, and it like touched any of the eardrum, it was like zzz.
Oh.
So you'd be like zzz. You'd be like and you know, you're 8, 9 years old when I was having that happen. I don't do it now. But it was like, it was something that would just clear it out. Like I was diagnosed with too much, I produced too much earwax or something. And so that, this is also the 80s. So I'm sure it was nothing, but it was like, we got this new machine. The Reagan administration's really pushing this ear machine. So yeah, so I feel like that guy was in, I forgot his name, but he was in Crystal Lake.
Are you concerned at all? Anybody coming to Duke's on Wednesday that has a beef?
Ooh, that would be good, right?
Listen, Kaufman.
There's some beefs, some long-standing beefs in that area. I mean, you know, I like to tell a lot of people that, you know, I just went to college, but really I just had to get out of town. There was just a lot going on in McHenry County, and I was like, I had to get out. No, I don't have any beefs. There are a couple, you know, there were a couple bullies, and there were a couple, you know, fisticuffs, if you will, You know, like we in the back in the day, we didn't use guns. You know, we use fists like a man. Like
that you got you would like Friday. You were actually got in a fight with somebody.
Oh boy, yeah, I got a great story. I'll tell it. I'll take a quick break and I'll tell you a great story of how I got punched. You know, sure. Oh man, I can't wait for Crystal Lake, Pete. The texters that are texting, it's just off the chain, as the kids say. It's amazing. I mean, you know, you talk enough about one area of the city or the region,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, it's people come out of the woodwork. I got people texting in, and be like, "I was at McHenry this year, you know. All the stores, Bergren's. Don't forget about service merchandise. Oh, what about the arcade?
Oh yeah. Did you? Were you a kid that used to go to the arcade?
I don't remember that arcade. Talking about, yeah, it's just so interesting. I don't know. It's you know, the one thing that I will say is I can't be that authentic because I'm not an OG Crystal Lake guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like I did go to McHenry High School and I went to Wonder Lake or lived in Wonder Lake, so that was 30 minutes away. But you spent time there. But a lot of my time was spent with my parents when we would drive to Crystal Lake. So it wasn't like I was getting dropped off at the arcade. It wasn't like I could ride my bike there.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like
yeah,
we had
a little bit too far.
We had arcades that were closer, like in the pizza and That's Pizza, a place we called That's Pizza, on Wonder Lake Road. And my favorite line of all time is, when I was back in high school, college, I had a public access TV show called Corn, Carp, and Cable TV.
What?
Yeah, and it was I gotta find tapes for you. It's really great. One of the funniest things of all time.
I can't even get into it.
I had a TV show. I went to the local public access, and I went in there and I said I would like to have a TV show, and they said no. And then I somehow was able to get in another meeting, and they said sure. And it was a sketch comedy show. It was like Saturday Night Live or Kids in the Hall or something.
Oh my God!
And so I just rounded up people that from the neighborhood kind of thing.
How prolific!
Very prolific. Lasted, I think we did like five or six of them maybe. But we did one that was like a top 10 list, you know, and for that and more things to do in Wonder Lake. And I think number one or number four, or whatever, was go to That's Pizza and ask That's why there's no brothers on the wall. Everyone do the right thing. Hey, Sam, why are there no brothers on the wall? Go to That's Pizza and ask That's. Just thought that was funny. That's what brought that up. Yeah, Corn, Carp, and Cable TV. Look it up. But there's the best part, and I want to do this for like an hour, because we actually got part of a award show. They did an award show, and it was pretty low rent. Like, it was the kind of thing that they did in the studio live, but the cuts, you know, it's just public access and the way you do it. And I just remember... like I had a videotape of it, and it was one of those things where I gave the videotape to my buddy Neil, or we were living together in Chicago, and I go, "You want to watch this?" We were watching. He's like, "What's this?" You know, award show, and we watch it, and he just thought it was. It turned into like functional art.
Yeah,
like it was one of those things that was like such a train wreck, the broadcast of it, that it became. It actually circulated in New York City. Like, it was the kind of thing, like, you want to see, like, we were making plans to redo it, and you couldn't do it because it was, you know, the actual art was everything about it, the VHS, everything. Just the way the award show was, it was a riot. And so, somewhere along the line, that tape disappeared. So, hopefully it I feel like it might be the genesis or the inspiration for the Adam Greens and the Harmar Superstars up in Brooklyn, you know, doing their crazy art up in, you know, the warehouses of Brooklyn. Yeah. I believe it started with that tape somewhere. They saw it and they're like, I want to do this. So if you ever find it. Anyway, the story where I got punched was a school thing where I was a sophomore and I was in gym class and there were seniors. We were playing softball in gym class.
Always comes back to softball.
A girl came up, and I can't remember her name, and it's probably better for the story anyway. She hits a ground ball to the pitcher, right? I was playing first base. I think it was a freshman, actually, and these were all seniors. I was playing first base, and I had some hands, so I got to play with the seniors. They'd throw it over there. And then, like, I was just being cocky, and, like, I ran by her, and I'm like, I dropped the ball maybe, like, at first base, but then stepped on the base, but she didn't run. So, like, I walked by and I'm like, always hustle. You know, something that you, like, my dad taught me, right? Always hustle. You could have got it. And she swears at me, like, loudly, because she was a popular girl. She's like, you know, And the gym teacher's right there. And he's like, Jenny, loop or, you know, take a lap. Because if you swear in gym class, you can run around the outside of the school. Not something that the senior girl wanted to do, right? Mm-mm. So she runs around. She comes back. She's still steaming. She comes up to me like, you, beep, beep, beep. Gym teacher's right there. Gym teacher goes, Jenny, what did I tell you? Again. Let's do it again. So now she's on two, right? She's steaming. With the bell rings to come back in, and I'm walking back in, and she, like a bully, like gets right up on me, like on my back, right? And I've said one thing. I said one thing. You know, which was, come on, get a hustle. Like, thinking I was smart ass, right? She then, like, is being a bully where she's kind of, like, almost pushing it. And I turn around and go, what are we going to do here? And she punched me in the back of the head.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Assault.
It was assault. It was a straight-up assault. I went right to the police. No, just high school, you know. Yeah. This girl hit me. And there's nothing you really do in that situation as a freshman, you know, who's, I mean, what are you going to do? Am I going to fight back?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there's no real win. You can't. So I was kind of made fun of by the gym class. It was just kind of like Justin got beat up by a girl kind of thing. And my weirdest thing, and the whole thing was so weird to me. And I remember one of the jocks who was like a senior is like, she did that to me, bro. I would have laid her out. And I was just like, what are you talking about? Get away. I'm just going to go. I'm going to go do radio in Chicago. So yeah, maybe that's the only beef. So maybe she shows up. I can't remember her name, so that would be. But it'd be awesome if she showed up in Crystal Lake.
Oh,
at Duke's,
that would be incredible.
Like, and she extends her hand to handshake, but then she pulls it back and punches me again. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coppin. Well, it's time for Studio 435, our weekly showcase. Chicago musicians performing live in our Allstate Showcase studio here on Michigan Avenue. Tonight, the indie rock sounds of the Purcells. The Purcells just released their debut album, Words Can't Say, and they're playing at Shuba's on February 3rd. Eric Troinar, Al Haniger, and Don Yannick are in studio right now, and they're ready to kick it off with the track After School Special. Take it away, guys.
I go down a different way. Same old sled, a different race. Drive my car, talk to myself. Brand new sled, different face. I know, I think it's something different every time. And you're tired. Of catching up with me and my old friends. On the hill, dragging up my lunch tray into the wind, fly past the trees, getting close to something I can't see. I know. I think it's something different every time. And it's real. It doesn't matter how many times I'm wrong. It's real. It's real. It's real. It's real. It's real. It's real. It's real, can be real. It's real, can be real.
Yeah, all right. The Purcells live in Studio 435 tonight. They just released their album, Words Can't Say. They're playing at Shuba's on February 3rd. That's Eric Troinar, Al Henniger, and Don Yannick in studio. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll get these guys around the table. We'll talk about their music and hear some more Studio 435. Stay with us. All right, Studio 435, our weekly showcase of Chicago musicians. Today, the Purcells just released their debut album, Words Can't Say. They're playing at Shuba's on February 3rd. We're going to hear some more music from Eric Troinar, Al Henniger, and Don Yannick in just a moment, but they join us around the table now. Guys, thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Yeah,
all right, so let me ask you. I mean, I kind of set it up saying the indie rock sounds of the Purcells. It's a very, what we heard in the first one is very... reminiscent. I'm trying to think of the like a very 90s indie rock. I think of like Yola Tango, those kind of bands. Talk about your influences or what are we supposed to, what category do we put you guys in?
Well, I think it's interesting you said the early 90s. I think because of our age, we initially first started calling ourselves college rock because that was sort of what they called it.
Right, right.
But yeah, Yola Tango is certainly one of our big influences, along with the Feelies. And who else would you say?
The Clean.
The Clean from New Zealand, yeah.
And so, I mean, what is that kind of music? When we're talking to people who might not be familiar with an early 90s kind of Yola Tango sound, what is usually highlighted in the music of that genre?
Maybe the Feelies and the Clean are a little bit primitive, influenced like everybody by the Velvet Underground. Jangly guitars.
Jangly guitar, yeah.
And really rhythmic. And that's mm-hmm. like the Feelies.
Yeah, melodic. Pop. I have to just think of it as pop music, but you know, it's stuff that's unfortunately not played on the radio very often.
Yeah, I was gonna say pop music.
Yeah.
Yeah, pop music has gone a long way from right. What was played on the radio in the early 90s. You know, for you guys coming together to play this kind of music, I mean, I'm trying to deconstruct the sound of what we heard in that song and also the record that we listened to today. You know, there is this vibe of, it does give me sort of a memory of a time. What attracts you guys to that kind of music? Because I'll hear a lot of musicians will come in through who call themselves indie rock, but it's a lot of sort of, I don't want to, you know, like it's just a little louder. It might be a little screechier. It might be a little more, I don't even know what the words are to describe it, but the point being, like, for you guys to come together, how does that happen that you guys come together in the love of this music or this style of music?
Well, we're all intense record buyers and have record collections. And I think it's a simple melody. Jangly guitar is what I usually listen to. Interesting vocals. Real simple drums, you know. I guess that's probably part of most of it is like just like a really fundamental sound. Nothing is over. Nobody's overplaying.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of space in the music. Guys, back me up here.
Yeah, hopefully there is some space in the music. And it's, you know, it harkens back to the kind of music that we listened to when we were probably 18 to 22. You know, a lot of that is the foundation of what we started playing, right? Because that's when we started playing
in
bands.
Sure. Take us back to that time. I mean, you guys being 18, 19, what drew you to music and for it to be something that was going to be a lifelong pursuit?
I don't know. Me probably listening to like the bands like The Replacements, being from Iowa and like knowing a lot of people whose, you know, brothers or sisters went to school in Minneapolis. So like bands like The Replacements and Husker Du, it made me feel like it's that it was something that I could do, that we could do in my high school band, write our own songs.
Actually,
and not have to be like some showy,
right?
For me, it was watching the Monkees when I was a kid. Like the idea of living in a house with your bandmates and having these, you know, crazy madcap times and playing songs. I mean, that just was incredibly appealing to me. So that was sort of my motivation, I think. And it probably I still feel that way a little bit.
Eric, how about you?
You know, I was somewhat of an introvert in my early college years, and I was going to all those shows, but I wasn't playing music live. I wasn't coaxed up on stage very often until I was 22 or 23. But we were seeing a lot of the same bands, and bands like Yo La Tengo in the early days, very scrappy, and they would just tour up and down the East Coast. I'm from the East Coast, and got to see them play a lot and got to see them grow as a band and thought, wow. You know, I saw them play and they could barely hold it together, and now they're amazing. So,
well, I mean, I have a lot of questions about the album. This is your debut album, Words Can't Say. You guys put out an EP before. You also had the split 7-inch that you did. You know, this the process of putting together a full album and actually getting ready to support it. I mean, because you guys put it out in December 2016. I'm assuming you're touring. You got a show at Shuba's coming up on the 3rd. But how in this day and age do you support? I mean, that's such an old, it almost feels like an old way to talk about music, to support a record. I mean, do you go out on the road? Do you just hit your Facebook page? What is it today that you have to do to sort of push the record? That might be different than, you know, the times we're talking about when you guys were, you know, 20, 22 years old.
I don't know. You want to talk a little bit about, like, when we sent it out, like, we had to be kind of honest with at least a record label about you know, Don and I are both school teachers. We're all dads. And so we talked about maybe being able to do, like, extended weekend kind of mm-hmm. mini tours around the Midwest, but or possibly little longer summer tours because Don and I are both teachers and Eric has some flexibility in his job. But
it's different than when you guys were jamming it out when you're 25 years old,
right?
I would
say our big motivation this time was just that, like I said, we're both, all three of us are big record collectors. So the idea of having our own record on vinyl and being able to hold it in our hands, like that's a big motivation. And whether or not like we end up touring or going anyplace, I mean, that for me, that's a little bit secondary, but just the idea of being able to make this product and, like I said, have it in my hands and share it with people is sort of enough now. But
I agree. That was always kind of a dream of mine from college on, like make a record, a full record.
Well, dreams do come true. Al Henniger, Don Yannick, Eric Troinar in studio. The debut album is out. It's Words Can't Say. You can get it at Bandcamp. You can find it. It's streaming all over the place. The record's out. The Purcells in studio 4:35 tonight. What are we going to hear? Let's hear another track. What do you guys want to play next?
This one's called Bleed Into Blue.
Bleed Into Blue. All right. I'll stall while you guys get up on the microphones, get your stuff plugged in. Ready, Bob? Oh, yeah. Studio 435, of course, our weekly showcase of Chicago musicians and bands performing live right now in our Allstate Showcase studio. The indie rock sounds of the Purcells. Take it away, guys. We'll be right back.
some flight. My old friend, cursing my old self, move past the night into the sun, burn out in a day and miss everyone. My old friends, cursing myself, we pass the night into the day, living my whole life with this way. Make it all right. Bleed it all into the blue.
Purcell's live in Studio 435. They just released their debut album, Words Can't Say. They're playing at Shuba's on the north side February 3rd. We'll get more from the Purcells here in Studio 435 after the break and after the update for this tonight's news coming up here on 720 WGN. Thanks, Rob. Studio 435, our weekly showcase of Chicago musicians and bands performing live in our Allstate Showcase studio. Tonight, the indie rock sounds of the Purcells. They just released their debut album, Words Can't Say, and they're playing at Shuba's on February 3rd. Eric Troinar, Al Henniger, and Don Yannick in studio. You know, we were talking a little bit about, you know, just the fact that you guys are record collectors and you wanted to put out a record. You know, but at the same time, I mean, as you guys get older and you've been in music and you've been around music and you do, your lives do change, you got families and teachers and everything that you guys mentioned, how important is it that you got that record accomplished?
Well, it was a long time in the making. It took us, we recorded for about a year, but we probably had like one or two songs done 6 months before that. So we recorded all in my basement and like the basic tracks, and then Eric and I do vocal or overdubs. Sometimes he does those separately in his house, but
the wonders of computing.
It was a little bit of a glacial pace, you know, because we would get everything set up and do all the sound check and the levels and everything, and then maybe have like an hour and a half to put down a track or drum tracks, and so it took maybe almost 2 years for us to do the record, right?
I think so. Really.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because a lot of times you'll have bands in here, and one of the simple questions, and I think it can be a complicated one as well, is just about ambition. You know, the concept of what are you playing for? I mean, you get a lot of bands that will say, okay, well, is it the same as it was? And, you know, when I remember all the roommates that I had in college and things that were like, I'm going to play, I'm going to get a record label to look at us, and then we're going to press some records, and then we're going to go on tour. Next thing you know, we're rich and famous and we're living in Malibu. For you guys, I mean, as I think that more and more musicians that come through Studio 435, it's more of a lifelong pursuit of the craft of being in the moment and being creative musicians. I mean, is that accurate to describe you guys just having this conversation that it's much more about the union that you guys have had together, the three of you, but than necessarily chasing some sort of Hollywood Capitol Records dream?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely for us. And, I'll just do this one thing. The question we would get all the time is like, we'd say we were rehearsing or we're practicing, and people would be like, why, do you have a gig coming up? And one of us would be like, well, no. And they would wonder, well, what are you practicing? Well, because it's fun. You know, we like playing music together. We improvise, we goof around playing covers. So it's for us, and making the record is for us. And playing shows, I think it's kind of a bonus.
Yeah. I always felt that it's been more important when I've been in a band, and I've been in a lot of other bands, is that the people I play with, I'm comfortable with and sort of friends with, because like you said, it is kind of, there's that social element that is always going to be there. So I'd much rather play in a band with, you know, people that I'm comfortable being around than sort of the best musician that has the best chops, because, you know, we're not really into...
What are you saying about my chops?
showmanship or anything like that. But it's more about the feel and, you know, I guess just hanging out. So
yeah. Eric?
It's a social thing for us as well as a creative production thing. You know, I think that we enjoy it, and that's the bottom line. So the bonus for us is when anyone else listens to it and likes it. But we're making it for ourselves, really.
Eric Troinar, Al Henniger, and Don Yannick in studio. They are the Purcells. They're playing at Shuba's on February 3rd. Is it a sort of a record release party for you guys, or you've already done that, right?
The vinyl is not going to be out until like April now.
Okay.
So we started thinking it was going to be a record release party.
It's a digital
release.
There you go. Yeah, on February 3rd at Shuba's, the album Words Can't Say. Okay, you guys are going to play one more track. What are you guys going to play here?
It's called Things Fall Apart.
Things Fall Apart. The Purcells in Studio 435. Of course, like I just said, the debut album Words Can't Say, and they are playing at Shuba's, but Belmont and Southport on February 3rd. Eric Troynar, Al Henniger, and Don Yannick. Here this Things Fall Apart. Take it away, guys.
Sometimes arise, shake and shiver, but don't be surprised. Heavy notion come crashing down. You never catch it all on your own. You take it hard, things fall apart suddenly. You take it hard. Whisper to me, deep in the dark. Don't let your guard down before you depart. Clouds of anger that's leading the sky. You can't avoid it, don't even try. You take it hard. Things fall apart suddenly. You take it hard.
Yeah. So Purcell's live in Studio 435. The debut album Words Can't Say. And they're playing at Shuba's on February 3rd. And the band is Eric Troynar, Al Henniger, and Don Yannick. Guys, thanks so much for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Welcome back here to The Download. Like we said, we're going to be in Crystal Lake. Coming up here, excited. Are you excited? I'm excited, Pete. Pete, what do you know of Crystal Lake, Illinois?
I know absolutely nothing.
Oh, that's how we like it.
Nothing. I had to look it up on a map.
Really?
I wasn't even... Well, I mean, I knew that
there
it was
is a
around
lake.
Where you lived.
Yeah,
but...
there is a lake. That's the one thing I do know. There is a Crystal Lake.
Huh.
Yeah, but, you know, Crystal Lake's, it's funny because there's a lot of towns in that area where you will think that the lake is, like, the main part of the town.
Mm-hmm.
But Crystal Lake, to me at least, is not one of those towns. Crystal Lake's almost like the lake is an afterthought. I don't mean that in any, you know, I don't mean it in disrespect to the area, but there's a lot of lake culture, you know, like, you know. Just
yeah,
say,
like
oh,
Blarney Island type of
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, that's straight up, you know, everything's about the chain of lakes there, but this is a little different. Like, if you're in Crystal Lake, you don't necessarily have to live on the lake.
Are there things to do? Like, do people use the lake?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, people swim and boat and...
And they got some cool beaches and things like that. But, yeah, it's for me, Crystal Lake is all about... I think it's... Man, I'm going deep, but it's like Route 14. That's
the main drag?
That's the main drag. And you had, and I don't know if it's still there. Like, I feel like I don't really know if these places are still there, but the Best Buy, the Round the Clock, the guy texted in last week and said that there's a Village Squire, which is a restaurant that's new in Crystal Lake, and then the old Showplace Theaters, hot spot, real hot spot, a lot of good memories.
I think we have to incorporate these memories into some sort of game.
I know, right? We got to figure. I feel like that's going to be my whole day tomorrow, because we're not on tomorrow night because of the Blackhawks. I feel like all I'm going to do tomorrow is just think Crystal Lake games. Right?
I'll dig deep. I'll go to the Chamber of Commerce. I'll give them a call. Talk to them for a little while.
Yeah, right.
See what they.
I know. I feel like because Crystal Lake is a pretty big suburb. Like, it's not. You know what it really is? It becomes sort of the first of its kind when you think about the suburbs of Chicago and McHenry County, because Woodstock, Illinois, not necessarily a suburb of Chicago. You're going further away, and you're like, it is because it's in the Chicago ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
But you're starting to get to a point where you're like, well, that's a little further out, right? But Crystal Lake, that's
still
like
part of the...
That's like suburban property.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, at least in my mind. Because if you get on Route 14 in Crystal Lake, you can go through Cary, Fox River Grove, into Barrington. I forget, there's a town in there I'm missing somewhere along the line. But it's like essentially following the train line along Northwest Highway.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Yeah, right?
Excited to go to Duke's.
It's going to be fun, man.
We have a band,
I went to, we do, Jim and Justin. And they're acoustic duo, so they're going to help us out, play some music, some live music, because that's like one of their spots.
Mm-hmm.
Duke's is like one of their spots, and they're really, really popular, so I'm excited to have them there. I feel like we should have done the show like on a Friday or Saturday night, you know, like really to get the Crystal Lake Duke's experience.
Yeah. Well, Wednesday, that's almost the weekend.
It's almost the weekend. It's the weekend somewhere.
Mm-hmm. That's a saying, right?
The download. It's the weekend somewhere. Is that a saying? I don't know if that's a saying. It's Friday night somewhere. It's good. Yeah, so Wednesday, 7 to 10 at Duke's, Crystal Lake.
Mm-hmm.
The download will be there. We're excited to bring the show on the road for the Allstate Hometown Voices Tour. We've got McHenry County Board Chair Jack Franks. My old buddy from high school, Stu McVicker, is going to be there to talk about Club 400. Jim and Justin, as we mentioned,
mm-hmm.
the acoustic duo. Greg Flam's going to be there. I didn't even mention that.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Greg from the swap meet is going to be out there, so he can talk to anybody who wants to bring anything out there. It's like, I got this cool bat. I got this cool baseball. I got this cool book, whatever. Greg can tell you how much it's worth. We got a lot of stuff going on, so I feel like there's going to be plenty. And I think it's going to be packed. I put it up on Facebook, and people are like, I'm coming out, bro.
And get there early. Get there.
Right?
Get there 6 o'clock.
I mean, I wonder how it's going to work, because the way there's a stage in the front room, but it's a, you know, Duke's Ale House. It's got like, it's a dinner place essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, people will probably, you know, kind of just lounge on those tables, and Duke's going to be like, yo, got to turn those over.
I don't know. Perez says it's getting a lot of buzz. I don't know if that means anything.
It means a ton.
I'm jealous. I'm going to miss you guys.
I have had so many people text in that said, I'll go if Martyr is there.
Yeah.
No, stop.
It's nonstop, dude.
My mom doesn't count.
Hey, man, she's texts a lot from a lot of different area codes then. I'm telling you, you and Esmeralda, you guys should come out, man.
We'll be holograms.
You could do the traffic from Crystal Lake. You could do, like, what's happening on...
Specific Crystal Lake traffic.
Crystal Lake, what's happening in the old Best Buy? What's happening in the old Crystal Point Mall? What's happening around the clock?
How many, it's bottleneck how, traffic
bottleneck
due
traffic.
To the sale at the Kohl's.
That's right. See? Nailed it. Right? All right. So that's Wednesday night. The download live at Duke's. High school. spoke too soon on the Nobody Uses Crystal Lake. Scott, who's been one of the Crystal Lake guys who texts in, just texts a photo of a, it looks like a muskie or a northern pike or something. Huge, huge fish. Just sent in the picture of catching it one summer. I mean, he barely can hold it. So I guess I was wrong on the.
He should bring it to Duke's and have Greg Flam appraise it.
Does he have it mounted, or is it just like he just pulled it out of the
water?
In
this picture, he's got it, you know, pulled out of the water, like he's holding
it's
in it
the
like
freezer.
Yeah, that's what I want to know. Yeah, bring the fish, and Greg will tell you how much it's worth.
If it's a muskie, good for him, man. That's a fish of 1,000 casts.
It looks like a muskie. I mean, it's huge. The thing's huge. And I know. Yeah, he said 49.5-inch muskie.
It's bigger than my daughter.
Also, 815 says, tell those two yahoos on the radio, I think they're talking about you, Esmeralda and Rob, Crystal Lake is a city, not a suburb. So here we go.
I didn't refer to it as a suburb.
No, it was Rob and Esmeralda, and you can check
it. Wasn't me.
Rob
Did
and
I
Esmeralda
say suburb?
Show. The Rob and Esmeralda Show, 7 to 11.
I'm going to go back in the logger and pull that.
Although I'm from Joliet and I call that a suburb.
Yeah.
I believe it's the city of Joliet.
I offended somebody, but that's all right. I apologize. City of Crystal Lake. Okay. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNradio.com. Patty Vasquez up next here on 720 WGN.